Good afternoon, everyone. I pretty routinely get going by 1:34, 1:38, so I'm disappointed in myself. But I call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 1:38 p.m. on Wednesday, March 18th, 2026. Present today are Representative Ballard, Representative Stapp, Representative Moore, Representative Hannon, Representative Galvin, Representative Jimmy, Co-Chair Foster, and myself, Co-Chair Josephson. Also present today are House Finance Committee Staff Committee Assistant Helen Phillips, Paige Tallulah-Lastufka, Secretary Bree Wiley, and Secretary Leah Frazier. We also have our moderator, Emily Mesh, from the Legislative Information Office with us. Before we start, please mute your cell phones. In today's meeting, we will hear the Department of Transportation Public Facilities present on leasing and facilities. Then we will again take up House Bill 193, Unemployment Benefits, paid parent leave. With us today from the department is Dom Pannone, Director for Program Management Administration, Danny Gibson, Director for the Division of Facility Services, and Christopher Hodgen, Chief for Statewide Facility Services. Would Director Pannone, Director Gibson, and Chief Hodgen please come forward, put yourselves on the record, and begin your presentation.
Good afternoon, Mr. Co-Chairs and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Christopher Hodgen. I'm with our statewide public facilities team, serving our Division of Facility Services and our Department of Transportation. Thank you very much for the opportunity today and the privilege to share with you. So I'd like to introduce Director Gibson.
For the record, Daniel Gibson. I'm the Director of the Division of Facility Services. Good afternoon, committee members, and thank you for the opportunity to speak today on facilities and leasing. We'd like to get going and... At the Division of Facility Services, our mission is to deliver, improve, and maintain safe and reliable facilities across the state of Alaska. We do this through essentially four functional areas of our team. We have our statewide public facilities, and this team of licensed engineers, they're the authority on vertical construction for the state. Typical projects include new facilities, it could be deferred maintenance or energy retrofit projects. We also have our maintenance and operations team who are strategically placed throughout the state of Alaska. It's a multifaceted team, everything from maintenance generalists to, God willing, if we can find them, licensed plumbers and electricians. And they are tasked with delivering preventative, routine, and general maintenance, as well as emergency response for DOT and PF owned and operated facilities. We also have a number of maintenance agreements with other agencies to take care of their facilities as well. We have our administration team who's supporting service delivery through DFS by mastering and managing our administrative tasks and reporting. And we have our leasing group who's responsible for procuring, administering, and managing leases and contracts for space on behalf of the executive branch.
Okay, slide three.
Taking a look at our portfolio, we first wanted to make sure everyone understood what we were discussing when we're talking about state-owned public facilities. The Division of Facility Services owns and operates 706 facilities across 233 locations across the state. It's over $2 billion in value, and it's over 4.25 million square feet of facility space. We break this up. You can look on the chart. On the slide, 668 of these facilities are DOT and PF occupied buildings. Examples of these would be highways and aviation maintenance shops. It could be SEF maintenance bays. It could be warm storage buildings, material labs, etc. They're all buildings that solely support the mission of DOT and public facilities. Then looking at the left half, which is basically the equal amount of square foot as our of our 668 buildings. We have 38 buildings that we consider multi-tenant or occupancy buildings, and they're broken up two ways. One is we have 26 facilities that are DOT owned and occupied by other agencies not named DOT. It's a rate based on actuals, and we have occupancy agreements with those agencies to pay rent, basically. And we also have 12 facilities that belong to the Public Building Fund. The Public Building Fund is similar in the fact that it's owned and operated by us. It's a rate-based occupancy agreement. The difference is that rate also includes depreciation So it has a separate fund that can be accessed for capital improvement projects as we deliver and maintain those facilities. Examples of these would be the Juneau State Office Building, Nome State Office Building, Fairbanks Regional Office Building, and a number of others, primarily the majority here in Juneau.
Okay.
I will note that these buildings do not include AMHS facilities or international airport facilities. Those are operated and maintained through their independent strategic assets of the department.
All right. Slide four.
So outside of our space management and our state-owned facilities, we also have our leasing program, which operates under statute 3630.80, which gives them the authority to manage, administer, and procure contracts and lease space for the executive branch. So essentially, looking at the flow chart, an agency will come to us looking for space. We will then sit down with them, and they'll fill out a space allocation spreadsheet, which is essentially a spreadsheet based in space needs per BOMA, which is the Building Owners Management Association. And it kind of lays out the amount of square feet you might need for a certain type of position, for a certain number of people, certain type of delivery, service delivery. So that will start to quantify the amount of space we're looking at for an agency. And then we'll also have them fill out a lease action report or request form, which is really the financial equipment, the financial commitment to then move forward with a procurement of said lease or space. Our first priority when we're looking for space is always in our state-owned facilities. We don't generally have a lot of movement in our state-owned facilities. They're 98% occupied at this point. And when I say these lease facilities, I'm referencing the 38 facilities on the previous slide. If we don't have space to accommodate the agency there, then we'll turn and look to procuring lease privately spaced through a number of methods, whichever is the best suited for the situation.
Okay. We have a question from Rep. Hannon.
Thank you.
Is it Mr. Hodgin?
Mr. Gibson.
Apologies.
Thank you, Chair Josephson. Mr. Gibson, I am thinking back to a couple years ago when DEC in Anchorage was going to, quote, give for free to the permanent fund some space to use for staff, PFD Corporation moving some staff up to Anchorage. Was that completely outside of what... How do they go about doing that without involving DOT or when they end up with extra space and giving it to another department for free? Or is that something you know nothing of and I am just busting them here on the record?
Mr. Gibson.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, that's a great question. I'm not particularly informed of the specific instance. We do have usually in our state-owned facilities – we generally have a pulse and work with agencies prior to them moving and have almost always, in most cases, filled that space before it actually becomes vacant.
One follow-up?
Yes, and if I might, Representative Bynum joined us at 1:45.
And
Rep. Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Josephson. Mr. Gibson, is it a requirement that any time one agency or state Permanent Fund Corporation is occupying another agency's space, that there be a cost accounting for it? I know that we're not actually exchanging rent checks, but that an agency can't say to another agency, you come here and it's free to you because we like you and would like you to be our neighbor.
Mr. Gibson.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Hannon. I'm not aware of any situations like that. It's very possible they could, but we should be involved in that, and there should always be a documented space lease.
Thank you.
Okay. Rep. Galvin for Director Gibson.
Thank you, Director Gibson. I appreciate learning about the multitude of ways that you are engaging with facilities, and I have a question that's a little bit outside the box. sorry, but I'm trying to imagine how I see on slide 6, for example, Deed is using 0.4%, very, very little. And we have, when you mentioned taking care of their facilities as well for these other ones, it brought to mind how much of a workforce you have doing a lot of upkeep of facilities. And what came to my mind was buses and bus housing buses and things like that, which I don't think has ever been done by the state. But we are in such a predicament right now of trying to find workers and people who keep maintain the roads for schools and all of that, and let alone making sure that we're keeping bus facilities up to date, up to speed in our larger hubs. So it makes me wonder if this is something you could imagine opening a conversation that would include how to better support educational facilities. Is that even possible?
Director Gibson.
Through the chair, President of Galvin, that's a great question. I do want to clarify, we do not currently maintain or service any of the education facilities, as they're not state owned. However, we would always be open to collaborating with other governmental agencies and municipalities on what that, you know, we all want to be the best service provider we can.
Thank you, Co-Chair Justice, and I appreciate you allowing me to enter into this conversation, even though it may not be the direct report, because we're trying to think creatively about how I know that Department of Transportation has excellent workforce already doing a lot of things that are needed in many of the maintenance areas, in some of the same areas like roofing and, you know, so much of the same pieces. And so I want to encourage us to think outside of the box. And I'm grateful to hear that you're open to those conversations. And I look forward to more down the road. Even. Thank you.
Okay, please proceed.
This is mostly, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but this is mostly for the committee's awareness. This is just a breakout of private lease space amongst the agencies. I will clarify that this is indicative of total lease space.
Okay. Slide 7.
Can we go back?
If you want to go back a slide or two, you're welcome.
Yeah, thank you. Apologies. We skipped one. When we were looking at our portfolio, we have our state-owned facilities, we have our leasing facilities, so we wanted to make sure we were comparing and contrasting those appropriately for the committee. Within our state buildings, we operate space management, or we document it through occupancy agreements, as I mentioned. We currently have 146 of those agreements being managed through our leasing program, and that comprises about 1.6 million square feet. And as I mentioned, 98% occupancy at this point. When we switch to our private leased facilities, overall what we'll see is right now we have 3.6 million square feet leased out. But I did want to clarify that for the committee that we do a number of different types of leases, everything from office space leases to ground leases to warehouse housing. We do leases with private agencies for a number of different types of lease. So when it comes to comparable office space to the 1.6 that we have in state-owned facilities, we have basically a mirrored 1.6 million in private lease for office space for executive branch agencies. And then there's another 2 million of lease space that that makes up, like as I mentioned, land, warehouse, storage, and housing. The large amount of that square footage is ground lease, with the remaining ones all less than 1%.
Okay. Director Gibson, question from Rep. Allard.
Thank you, through the chair. Thanks for being here, you guys. A question. So we lease these facilities, and it sounded like we need more. Do we need more? Or am I reading into this? Are you okay with what we have, or are you ever looking for more space?
Director.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Allard. Capacity-wise, for the state of Alaska executive branch agencies to operate, we do not As the numbers indicate, we do not have enough to accommodate all those needs. We have our state-owned facilities at max capacity. Other agencies do own some of their own facilities as well. And then beyond that, there is a need of 1.6 million square feet to conduct business.
So, may I? Thank you. Do we make any money off of renting any of our stuff out, or are we at a break-even point? Because I think the Anchorage School District would have some buildings we could sell that we could buy from them. And I know that sounds sarcastic, but I actually mean it.
Director Gibson.
Through the chair, Representative Allard. We do have agreements in our state-owned facilities. We have agreements, so those agencies are paying rent. It's based on actuals, so we're not, as a department, we're not generating revenue.
Okay,
we're a pass-through essentially.
Okay. Well, I think, may I?
Yes, go ahead.
I think we seriously need to have a conversation with the Anchorage School District. The population is going down as far as students, and we have a lot of buildings that need to be sold off. Thank you. I didn't mean to trigger you, Trey.
Well, I just don't know. I don't feel terribly triggered. I just don't know whether the school district can be compelled to sell off. I don't know enough about
that. No, the people could compel them.
All right. So we'll go to, I think, slide 7.
Just wanted to touch on a couple of trends in leasing we're seeing. Really, in the last 5 or 6 years, we haven't seen a significant change in space requirements that have been requested by departments. Just to quantify that, I will say the average total square feet leased in FY 20 and 21 was 3.7 million. And as I mentioned in the presentation, currently for FY 26, we're leasing 3.6 million. So we haven't seen any kind of drastic reduction. And we've seen fluctuations throughout the years in between, some up, some down, all within a delta of about 5%. So we don't see people tend to move or reduce their space.
Okay.
We do see higher lease costs being observed, just a change from FY 25 to FY 26 for essentially the same amount of square footage. We went from $47.5 million to $49.2 million. So generally, as costs are going up, as everyone is, I'm sure, well aware, as we go into amendments and extensions of leases, we're seeing increases by building owners as a whole. One challenge that I did want to mention that we are finding it is it's becoming, as we look for space on behalf of agencies, there is a challenge, especially in certain locations where we aren't able to find exactly what the agency is looking for. I'll use one example. Here in Juneau, about a year ago, I believe it was Deed was looking for some space. We did a couple RFIs, RFQs that ultimately were unsuccessful because total square footage they were looking for, we couldn't find in one location. And that actually born a co-location effort in the Juneau State Office building here, where Deed is now co-located with DCCED. In a state-owned facility, which actually allowed us to terminate a lease of about 20,000 square feet. I say that as that's more of an exception, not the rule. We don't see a lot of co-location per se as a primary instance. However, within the department, we are looking at always trying to make sure we're using our space efficiently. And one example I'll mention for the committee is we recently finished repairing a building in Anchorage, the Annex building. So as we looked to fill that building and get it at max capacity, we looked around at other groups of our agency that we could move into that building. Ultimately, we found that we could move occupants out of the Kibata building in Anchorage into that building, which then freed up the Kibata building. And is essentially why you may have seen it's on a list for possible divestment. But that was a space consolidation we've internally done over the last year.
Director, a question from Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Oh, my goodness. Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson, through the chair. Director, I guess I'm trying to understand a take-home message here. It's sounding like there's a need for more office space for state agencies. And what I'm confused by is, to me, over the last 10 years or so, we've reduced so many state positions. I'm thinking about 100 in one division alone, 100 out of health. And indeed, we've reduced in Juneau by more than a half over the last 10 years. So I am trying to piece together, like, where are we? Who is asking for more? And if you could help me understand that, other than the one that you mentioned in Juneau. Juneau is a little bit unique, but hard to imagine with all of the empty buildings in my district, Midtown Anchorage. Quite a few are state-owned, and certainly the ones downtown. So if you could give me a sense of, if it makes sense to the chair, a little bit more detail on who's asking for more space, if that's true, if that's your predicament.
Director Pannone.
Yeah, for the record, Don Pannone. One thing I do want to say is we're not necessarily stating there's a need for more space, but what we are articulating at the request of the committee is that we as a department utilize lease space and manage our space when that makes sense, and that can be based on needs or policy calls. So in the prior slide where we were indicating lease space, mm-hmm. that's where we found leasing met the need versus owning the building. And I'll let Director Gibson continue the response to the question.
Director Gibson.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Galvin. These are just what the space requests coming from agencies that we're seeing and or not seeing. So obviously there's a multitude of variation out there on utilization that we may like visually see or know of. However, that's not necessarily coming through in a request to reduce or change the space footprint. Each instance is unique, and there's a variation of factors that would go into that, but ultimately we're just not seeing those requests come through from the agencies.
Okay. Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson, and through the chair, thank you very much, gentlemen, for being here today. Have you or do you perform a space allocation study for use of space or need for use of space by type? And if so, is that publicly available?
Director Gibson.
Through the chair, Representative Bynum. As I mentioned earlier, we do not necessarily a study, but we do work through space allocation spreadsheets with agencies as they're looking for space, on trying to help them best utilize that space and know how much they need. As everybody's well aware, there's no space standards in effect currently. Within our own facilities, we haven't performed those studies, but we're actively looking for efficiencies, which is why we've increased our occupancy at the Annex Building in Anchorage.
Follow up.
Thank you.
Bynum for Director Gibson.
Appreciate that. So one of the things that I think about when I think about need for space is space type. And then when I think about the space type, I look at what is my cost per square foot. Obviously, I can own my own facility. There's a cost to that, even if we aren't really identifying that. Obviously, we are going to be talking about deferred maintenance in a minute here, and that's a hot button topic for me. But ultimately, there's a cost per square foot when we talk about leasing space, whether it's leasing it from a state agency or we're leasing it from the private entity. Are we documenting the actual space per square foot? And then if so, are we doing that by region and type?
Director Pannone.
For the record, Don Pannone, and through the chair, Representative Bynum. So we have multiple methodologies for lease space. And for our public building, for the DOT buildings, when we have shared occupants that are other state agencies, in our annual rate, we do provide a rate per square foot. When we allocate out the total building cost based on the prior year's actuals, we provide the cost per square foot to our customer agencies. When we lease from a private entity, yes, we have all of the costs per square foot. And then with the public building fund, we do know the cost per square foot plus any capital improvements that we're collecting through the rate for depreciation. So we do have those available. We do provide those to the other agencies when we're analyzing space utilization. And Director Gibson, do you have anything else?
Director Gibson.
None of this time.
Quick follow-up.
Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Justice, and through the chair. Do they have? Do you have that information that would be, I guess, available in a easy to, I guess, executive level summary that would kind of define those things, or is it just on a building by building basis? And, you know, what I'm trying to get at is do you have any kind of executive level information that would demonstrate what we're actually paying on private leases, cost per space by region, and what we're doing internally within the state governments or state departments?
Director Pinone.
Through the chair, Rep. Bynum. We could provide that back to the committee. We do have by department. So for the DOT-owned buildings, we do have that by department. We do have the information on our private leases by department and by location per square foot. And we do have that information in tabular form for the public building fund assets as well. So we can provide that.
Okay. Was there a question, Representative Hannon, for Director of Choice?
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. Mr. Gibson, you've used a couple of buildings in Anchorage by name, and not all of us are from Anchorage. So could you just tell me where the Annex building is? And I think it was the Kubota building or Kubota that you said may be up for sale, where they're located. And I don't know if they're both entirely office space or if they were more complicated spaces.
Director Gibson.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Hannon. Yeah, both are DOT-owned assets. They're both office space. The Annex is on Tudor and Lake Otis, and it was previously occupied by DOT. It's currently occupied by DOT. The Kubota building, unsure of the address at the moment. It was one of the DFS buildings, which meant DOT owned and occupied by another agency.
Is it near the Sullivan Arena?
Fairview.
Where?
Fairview.
Okay. Fairview. Yeah. Okay. Let's proceed.
Thank you. Last bullet is really, in lease space. When we enter into a lease space, they're pretty. It's a big ship. They're generally 10-year leases to 20-year leases. There's a big investment from an agency to improve it, to customize it how they need it. So one of the reasons we don't tend to see, it's a big ship. It's hard to turn. It's hard to move. So as we generally see a pretty stagnant. We get space and we keep it.
Okay. All right, we'll go into the next topic. Mr. Hodgin, did you have something you wanted to say?
Oh, for the record, my name is Christopher Hodgin, Statewide Public Facilities, and I'm certainly ready to transition into the deferred maintenance topic.
All right, so let's go to deferred maintenance.
Yeah, thank you. So the present backlog of our Department of Transportation and Public Facilities for deferred maintenance is approximately $373 million. And so what that comprises is about $210 million estimated from our public building fund facilities. Again, those were our office buildings that are in Juneau, Anchorage, Palmer, and Fairbanks, and approximately $163 million that's estimated from our Department of Transportation usage buildings and our DFS buildings. Again, those are our programmatic buildings, such as our maintenance stations, our snow removal equipment buildings, and some of our combined facility buildings. These are informed by facility condition assessments. So over the last year, we did facility condition assessments at 28 of our buildings. And then this year, we're doing more facility condition assessments at over 1 million more square feet of the buildings to help inform this deferred maintenance need. At the bottom of this graph, this just shows us the prior deferred maintenance appropriations from our general funds, just for committee awareness. So on the bottom left, it reflects our Department of Transportation DFS buildings. So on average, throughout the years, it comes out to a little bit of under $4 million per year. And on the bottom right graph for our PBF buildings, on average, it comes about to a little bit less than $5 million per year that we use towards deferred maintenance of our facilities. And so we take this money and then we either effectuate them through our design and construction process, or we're able to accomplish them internal with our maintenance and operation teams.
So, Mr. Mr. Hodgen, is it as easy as adding the two sides and coming up with a number of around $12 million that we invest in deferred maintenance per year?
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. Yeah, yes, but the categories, the PBF fund allocations are only towards those 12 buildings that are in like Anchorage, Palmer, Fairbanks, and Juneau. And just to help provide context on those buildings get PBF funds from their tenants. So it self-funds the deferred maintenance in those facilities, which makes it very nice programmatically. And then the DOT buildings and the DFS buildings, the complete programmatic DOT buildings, receive deferred maintenance funds from the general fund that's allocated through this body.
All right. I'm going to have some questions here myself. Yes. Rep. Hannon.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. So, Mr. Hodgen, I want to go to the PBF-funded deferred maintenance, and I want to understand if that annual amount, what percentage of maintenance is that? Is it reaching 10% of maintenance on an annual basis or 1%? And I know engineers hate, I'm not holding you to the specifics. Engineers and accountants hate my questions. I'm a social scientist. So I'm just looking to understand, because sometimes our engineer, Mr. Bynum, I think it's a 10% is the expected amount that we should be putting towards deferred maintenance on an annual basis, is my recollection of what he's asserted. So I'm trying to figure out if we're putting enough aside in our PBF fund annually to do that.
Mr. Hodgen.
Thank you through the co-chair. Thank you very much for that question, Representative Hannon. Also, I love that there's engineers in the room. Thank you. Thank you very much. So for context, on deferred maintenance and the annual appropriate amount for deferred maintenance, the reason I came back to this slide, and not just to talk just solely about PBF, but to talk about deferred maintenance in general, when you think about the total assets in your portfolio, there's a study sometime ago, several years ago, that talked about appropriate percentages that could be directed towards deferred maintenance, comparing it to the value of your assets. So if you think about our assessed building assets of $2 billion, you can say appropriate percentages can range in the 1% to 4%, putting that investment towards deferred maintenance to maintain those facilities. So in a $2 billion asset universe, you know, that comes out to about like $20 million like annually. Now, it's understood that you're not always going to have that amount of investment available for the facilities. So then you have to work with what you have and then allocate them to the most important facilities that you have.
Yeah. Yes, follow-up, Rep. Hannon.
Follow-up. Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. But Mr. Hodgen, I want to focus on the PBF fund because my understanding from that fund is that we designed it in a way that we were charging our tenants, ourselves, and users of it a percentage so that we would always have enough deferred maintenance for that. So I'm wanting to know if this $6 million in FY26 is meeting that standard of deferred maintenance just for those, and you know, because we've got a UGF issue with other buildings, but the PBF fund, if it is actually meeting our needs, or if our, when we established that, did we set it at too low of a standard because we now have greater maintenance needs than we're getting there? And I get that none of our agencies want us to jack up their rent, but if our design purpose was by creating that fund that we were going to always perpetuate the ability to keep up with the maintenance in that one section of 12 buildings, are we doing that?
Director, or let me get your title right here. Chief Hodgen?
Yeah, thank you, through the co-chair. I would say, like, when we did the facility condition assessments recently, so those facility condition assessments included the PBF fund buildings. So they also reflect the condition of those facilities. So in those facility condition assessments, the result of it was fair for the PBF buildings, reflecting the investment that's been happening in the past. So that the historical investment in the PBF facilities has like resulted in facility condition assessments for fair for those those specific facilities.
FAIR, F-A-I-R, FAIR.
Yes, F-A-I-R.
Okay.
Yes.
Not good.
Yeah. Well,
just
fair to me.
Well, I guess that not knowing what the scale is, fair to me. If we've set up a fund to maintain our buildings in this PBF fund, so that it is, I want it to be better than fair. I want us, if we have these 12, that we set it up so that we're on top of it, because the others we're going to argue about. We got a lot of derelict and poorly maintained, and it's on us. We haven't kept up with it. So I'm wanting to know, are we keeping up in a really good way? Are the roofs all solid? I used to represent Haynes, and I got a public safety building there that I can't believe OSHA would let us occupy. And it hasn't gotten better in the last 8 years. So it's not a PBF building. I want to make sure that we're at least maintaining the ones where that we're charging enough and doing the maintenance. So is FAIR a good grade in your scale? Because I would think that good tells me that the HVAC systems work, the roof doesn't leak, the doors are all secured. And I know that not all of our buildings are those the conditions, and it doesn't seem a lot to aspire to, but that's what I want.
Chief.
Yeah, thank you through the co-chair, Representative Hannon. Our public buildings there have so many systems. And overall, it is still like FAIR and all of the systems are working. But in context, there are some systems that are older, that are in disrepair, that desperately need to be replaced. And there are newer systems that have been installed in recent years that are still good for – have a life for many, many years. So I wouldn't say that it is always wonderful to have more investment in the in the facilities so that we can replace more systems that will always be a need that we have. So if there's an opportunity to get more investment, then certainly that'll improve the scale of where they are.
Mr. Hodgson, maybe I should take this from another angle. And it could be that, myself included, that legislators have become so disenchanted with where we are in deferred maintenance that it's hard to disabuse ourselves of our feelings. Where we were, I think many of us, was that our situation is desperate. The school district has – all school districts have deferred maintenance and leaky roofs. The university has over $1 billion. I know that that's their problem. Of course, it's our problem too. And – you're saying that as to, first of all, the present, let's start with the present backlog at $373 million. Is that supposed to say that if I could give you $373 million and enough tradesmen and tradeswomen, you would run out of things to do in terms of deferred maintenance? In other words, you could solve all problems in DOT-managed buildings with $373 million? Or is there other sets of buildings not in DOT control that aren't being addressed? I'm trying to get the universe of this.
Thank you, Co-Chair. The $373 million is just reflective of Department of Transportation and public facility buildings. It is not reflective of all state executive branch buildings. That helps.
All right, so let's start there, because you control or manage, you know, control you. I don't know what the right verb is, to manage or to control. You're in charge of a number of state buildings, but what portion are you not in charge of?
Thank you, Co-Chair. We are just in charge of the DOT buildings in terms of operation of those DOT buildings.
Yep.
The other executive branch agencies, for their deferred maintenance projects, we may serve them as clients on deferred maintenance projects, or they may execute those projects themselves.
Yeah. All right. But take for example, well, I think down in the flats there are DNR and DEC offices. Mm-hmm. Do you manage those buildings, or do they manage those buildings?
Thank you, Co-Chair. They manage those buildings. We do not manage those buildings.
So if they have a maintenance issue, it's not part of this $373 million.
Co-Chair, that is correct.
Yes. All right. And do we have a sense of what all the others are combined that are not under your management?
Thank you. Thank you, Co-Chair. We do have a sense on that. So I believe I don't have the numbers off the top of my mind, but annual, like each year, the executive branch agencies submit their top priority deferred maintenance like projects. And we as a department help like facilitate that process to receive and kind of collect all of that, all of those projects so that it can be shared with the Office of Management and Budget. I believe last year, the top priority projects from all of those executive branch agencies was in the $80 million range. Those were just the top priorities at the time.
Okay. Yeah. I'll look to the committee so I don't hoard the time here. If yes, Representative Moore, then Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair. I'm not sure who my questions would be for, but I have a couple things written down here. Do you guys have how much of the backlog would be considered critical versus non-critical? Do you guys have an idea of this $373 million and the projects that are in there? Do you have a list of what you guys would maneuver towards first versus something that's not as critical?
Chief Hodgson.
Thank you. Through the co-chair, Representative Moore. Yes, we do have a list of last year our most critical like projects that we've got. It's not on this slide, but we've got it and we can present it to you.
Yeah, I would love something like that. And then
follow up.
Yes. Is DOT building any new buildings currently right now?
Chief Hodgson.
Thank you. Through the co-chair, Representative Moore. Yeah, we are constructing a new building at the Valdez airport. There's also a new snow removal building being constructed in False Pass, and then planned ones for Cordova, and then a few other locations that are very programmatic specific and like airport specific.
Follow up?
Yes, follow up. Rep Moore for Chief Hodgson.
Okay, so I'm just trying to figure out how we are building new buildings, but we have critical issues with deferred maintenance. And so how are we prioritizing new builds versus fixing what we need to fix first?
Thank you,
Chief Hodgson.
Thank you through the co-chair, Representative Moore. Those new buildings are the funding for those new buildings is from federal funding, FAA buildings. So that is totally using our federal source of funds for the new construction on those.
Okay, thank you for that answer. One more question.
Follow up more for Chief.
And then, in trying to tackle some of this for DOT for what you guys have presented for your backlog, is there items that you would cut or reprioritize within your current budget to address some of this?
Thank you, through the co-chair. Representative Moore, I think when we start prioritizing these, the types and categories of buildings that we would give lower priorities tend to go towards those cold storage like buildings where there's not much intensity of usage at those buildings. But even though they may be on our backlog because there are systems in those buildings to repair and replace and do projects on, they do not rise to the priority of where we must like fix them. So it's those storage buildings, those warehouse buildings that come much less priority in terms of what we're looking to do projects at.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much and appreciate you guys being here.
Rep Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Justice, and through the chair. So when we start getting into this conversation about deferred maintenance, I mean, I believe that when we have our own facilities and we own our facilities, we should absolutely be allocating a percentage of our value of these facilities aside for maintenance. And then we start getting these conversations of deferred maintenance. Does the department or the division currently have a specific definition that they're using to define deferred maintenance?
Chief Hodgson.
Yes, thank you. Through the co-chair, Representative Bynum. Yes, deferred maintenance, this is some guidance, I believe, from a OMB definition, is generally maintenance that is not able to be done in that annual year. And I can come back with the specific value to be accurate for the committee. but I believe it was over the $25,000 value as the definition for deferred maintenance. So when you think about what cannot be effectuated with the operating budget in that year, and that exceeds that $25,000 a year, then can get defined broadly as deferred maintenance.
Okay, perfect. Yeah, that's fine. Thank you. And through the follow-up.
Yep, follow-up. Rep. Yes, Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. So, you know, I think definitions matter here. And usually when I think of facilities, I think of maintenance that should have been completed that isn't completed and now is cataloged as deferred. Now, that doesn't mean that all deferred maintenance is critical maintenance, but it does mean that it's something we should be paying attention to. Do we do, or does do we do any use any kind of deferred maintenance ratio? Because when I think of this topic, you say deferred maintenance, I think on slide, let's look here, slide 8, you give us a number. You give us a number of $373 million. For backlog, I really don't know in the context of the scope of our facilities what that really means. It's a big number, but I really don't know what it means. Do we do deferred maintenance ratio for our facilities? And if so, do you know what that number is?
Thank you.
Representative
Bynum. As part of those facility condition assessments that I mentioned earlier, yes, there was a facility condition ratio for which is essentially the value of deferred maintenance projects, like over the value of what those the value of those assets.
Correct.
And so that ratio from the study that we did about a year ago was about 0.3, which comes to that fair, categorized as fair. So as we're going to do more of those this year, and so that'll help add to that ratio that we have.
Right. Appreciate that. And as just a closing comment on that, I mean, obviously when we start talking about deferred maintenance and how critical it is for our facilities and the condition of our facilities, having some metric for that deferred maintenance ratio really matters, because if we're saying that our deferred maintenance over the value of the facility is 20% or, you know, a 0.2, that's a big problem. That means that we're in failure, and that's something we should really be kind of starting to think about. So having a good picture of that and being able to categorize that to us in finance really lets us define how critical of a condition that our facilities truly are in, not just the big number. So I look forward to seeing additional information specifically on that so that we can start to get, I think, in alignment with what we should be investing. And it depends. Rep. Hannon had asked that question of, like, what's the number, 10% or something less? It depends on the facilities, obviously. It depends on where they're located. But if we were being healthy right now, we'd be putting between 2 and 4% of value of the facilities aside to say we need this for ongoing routine maintenance, not deferred maintenance. So I don't believe we're doing that. I don't believe that I've really seen specific requests to the legislature that that's what we should be funding, other than these deferred maintenance numbers. So that drives me to some level of concern. Thank you, Co-Chair, for the opportunity to discuss it.
Chief Hodgson, we hear a lot about the Utah model on deferred maintenance. Are you familiar with that?
No, sir, through the Co-Chair. Not the Utah model of deferred maintenance. I'm not, yeah.
I think it's more ambitious and reliable than our own. What we're told is that our own, and it's reflected on your slide 8, is very ad hoc. We don't really have a formula. We do what we can when we can. Is that fair? Except, I guess, for the public building fund, that's a formula of some sort, right? You've described that.
Yes, Co-Chair, yes. The public building fund is the self-funding one to self-fund deferred maintenance. But on the left, when we're talking about, like, general funds, that is the one that is not self-funded. So it's doing what we can when we can. And so we'll see some years where we are able to get, like, deferred funding, but then there are some years where there's no allocation, like, available. So then we do what we can to provide maintenance to our facilities.
Okay. Let's go to slide 9. Question from Rep. Tomaszewski.
Thank you, Co-Chair. So when we're talking about new buildings, new construction, is there any forethought put into deferred maintenance over the life of that building? Meaning, is there any way, or has there been any discussion or thought put into front loading those maintenance costs into the construction of the new building, like setting up a fund? If we have considered that, what does that look like? If we haven't, why do we not?
Chief Hodgin.
Thank you. Through the co-chair, Representative Tomaszewski, through the design process, then there is a an estimation like on for new construction and new buildings on how much potential energy and potential like maintenance might be required like into the future. And so that's provided in the design process and then shared like internally. And sometimes depending on the funding that is used for the new construction, whether it's federal funding or state funding, you might have funding available for maintenance and energy payments in the future of the building. Or in the case of like state funding, you may not have as much as you thought. So it's really, yes, we get the idea of like how much maintenance might be required for the new building. Then you share it internally and then work with our budget partners to see if we can fund the maintenance moving forward.
Follow up, Rep. Tomaszewski for Chief Hodgin.
Thank you for that. Seems to me setting up a system now to facilitate those maintenance concerns on the new buildings would eventually lead us to a point in time where the old buildings are going away, we're getting rid of them, and we're concentrating on the new buildings. We're setting up maintenance funds for them at time of construction. And that way, eventually, over a period of decades, we can and should be able to maintain our buildings through that process. And so I just don't I don't know if there's any way to look into that or maybe come up with some kind of a system to make that work. But it seems like something that would be prudent in over the long term, taking care of some of these deferred maintenance problems.
Director, Director Gibson.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Tomaszewski. That's a great question. We would totally agree with you. I did want to clarify one thing. We don't have a lot of new facilities coming. In most cases, those new facilities are new facilities, but they're replacements. So from an operating perspective, we don't tend to see, we're absorbing those, and usually they're more efficient through the design. I would mention, you know, if we were to see new buildings or some of our old facilities, I would look to the PBF model. And that's one thing we'd love to do is start to migrate facilities into a PBF fund model. For consistency's sake, the problem is it's a financial barrier that we haven't been able to overcome, as there's usually a large upgrade project funded that then we can start to depreciate and allocate those costs to the departments to start adding to that fund.
Okay, thank you. Let's go to slide 9.
Thank you. Slide 9. So this just touches a high level on how we prioritize and how those projects are allocated the funding. So for our top priority deferred maintenance projects, those are presented to the State Facilities Council for the ranking and prioritization. And the State Facilities Council is comprised of executive branch members from each department that owns facilities. And those projects are prioritized via via a rubric, incorporating such factors as mission alignment of the particular facility, the system that needs improvement, and the need to create a project index value that has to be ranked. Then after the Facilities Council has ranked and prioritized those deferred maintenance projects, then it's presented to the OMB, and then as they can, depending on the annual amount of deferred maintenance budget available, then they're able to fund those highest ranked projects. For those PBF funded projects in the PBF account that we control, so we're able to prioritize those like internally and then provide the recommended projects to OMB for allocation. So that gives kind of a general process of how we prioritize.
Representative Galvin for Chief Hodgin.
Thank you. And I believe Co-Chair Josephson that Representative Bynum may have already covered this, but this sense of that being there being a clear methodology for your prioritizing, is that something that's public? And I heard you say the words internal process as well, and that was, I believe, for possibly the council. But I just want to make sure if they're – I believe they're public, and I just – they're not part of this presentation, though. Is that right?
Thank you. Through the co-chair, Representative Galvin, thank you so much for the question. Yes, the methodology is certainly public. And then the when I was talking about internal prioritization, that was specific to the buildings that are in the PBF fund, so that we use a similar methodology for that. But the PBF-funded facilities, we do the internal prioritization because we're controlling those facilities and controlling those funds.
Thank you. And through the chair, is when you come up with your prioritization of what needs to be done, is that something that you can send to us so that we can see what, you know, the costs? And so I'm familiar with something through education where we see the big long lists and what the rankings are and that sort of thing. And I just might be helpful to see that. I know that we've also asked about just sort of a broad I guess a kind of an analysis of what and almost an inventory of what you have. But this sort of, to me, seems like it might be helpful just for projecting out our costs. And if we wanted to come up with something like a Utah, to know what we're facing.
Director Pannone.
For the record, Don Pannone, through the chair, Representative Galvin, the scoring that Chief Hodgin is referencing is the Facilities Council, where we have representatives from every department, and we score the needs based on an established rubric and matrix. So we could provide that scoring in those projects to you. And then for context, in the governor's budget this year, in the capital budget, we've proposed a $26 million capital income fund funded deferred maintenance appropriation and a $6 million public building fund appropriation. As we are the main managers of the public building fund facilities, we don't invite other stakeholders. We just do an internal scoring, which we can also provide to the committee.
Okay, thank you.
Rep. Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Josephson. So, Mr. Pannone, because you referenced the State Facilities Council list and then the amount that's currently in the governor's budget, can you tell us how much was on the entire list as opposed to what was proposed in the capital budget?
Director Pannone. Or either way, Chief Hodgin.
Through the co-chair, thank you, Representative Hannon, for the question. I can speak to last year's prioritization across all the executive branch agencies. And so roughly this represents all of their top priorities. It came out to about, I want to say about $80 million. And if you were, you'd be happy to share that list as well as Director Pannone shared.
So the administration chose, essentially funded through one mechanism or the other, 32 of 80 million that you've identified just now. You said 26 million regular capital deferred maintenance, 6 million public building fund that is in the FY26 capital budget for a total of 32 million. Is that what I heard?
For the record, Don Pannone, to the chair. So what Mr. Hodgin's referencing is last year's evaluation of projects that totaled 80 million.
Okay.
We'll look at the list this year as well and how to allocate the 26 million and the 6 million. And that is the amount that the governor's budget contains.
Okay. All right. Let's go to the final slide, slide 10, and close out on this. Okay?
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair,
Chief Hodgin,
very much for the opportunity. This just represents some of our project examples that have been completed or in progress right now. Some of our projects in Juneau include the Alaska office building roof replacement, some projects at our Juneau State office building that is near to us, some projects in Anchorage, Atwood building electrical system upgrades that will be in progress soon, and then some other projects in Ketchikan, Corton office building, and other buildings. These don't these ones that I had on this slide are mostly our office buildings, but we've got other projects in progress for our specific DOT programmatic buildings like maintenance stations and
forth. Okay. Rep Allard and then Bynum.
Thank you. Because I represent Eagle River, but Chugiak's part of my whole land too. Is there any state buildings in Eagle River that Chugiak Eagle River that need to be addressed and might not have made this list? We're kind of tiny when it comes to state though. Through the chair, I apologize.
That's okay. I'm not so sure this is a list as much as examples, but as best you can, Chief Hodgson.
Co-chair, through the co-chair, thank you, Representative Allard, for the question. I'm not off the top of my mind aware of any state building assets in that area.
We can check. Thank you.
You bet. Rep Bynum.
Thank you, co-chair Bezosin, through the chair. This is just a generalized question, and I guess anyone can take a crack at it. But I look down this list, and I see some of the items that are on this list, and it comes across, and the Ketchikan happens to be on this list. And sometimes when I just want to think about, like, what is the health of an organization and what is the health of a facility, is I do the walk-by test and see how much of the weeds and seeds are being done. And today, if we were to take a tour of the Ketchikan Courthouse and Office Building, we would walk by it and you would think that it was an abandoned building or lack of maintenance, because I would see weeds growing out everywhere in the sidewalk. I would see unkept parking lots. I'd see poor maintenance in general. So how much are we prioritizing just the general weeds and seeds? I mean, this seems to be some of the lowest cost effort for the biggest gains in our facilities.
Chief Hodgson.
Thank you, through the co-chair, Representative Bynum. Thank you very much for the question, and then Director Gibson can help like add context to that. I know in Ketchikan, just to provide like overall context, we have in terms of our resources to do the general maintenance, we have one individual, I believe, in Ketchikan that not only does the Ketchikan Court and Office Building, but also does some of our DOT maintenance station assets there. So I believe their time is spent like doing as much as they can on the vital building systems that is possible. So they unfortunately do not always have the time to be able to do some of the groundkeeping items that may be available or that may be needed at those facilities.
Is a quick follow-up?
Yep, follow-up. Rep
and him again, thank you, through the chair. I'm not bringing this up because I want to cast any negative light on the current employee. Sounds like single employee that we have in Ketchikan. And I'm using Ketchikan as the example because that's my district, and I don't want to say anything else about anybody else's facilities in their districts. But it is very obvious to the public, and public perception matters. And so whether it's DOT facilities or how we treat and I won't even get into what are we doing for road sweeping along the highway? I mean, these are the things that clog up my mailbox. For the just general weeds and seeds. And it really indicates the health of an organization. So I think that it's something that when we talk about priorities, that really for the cost of what it takes to do those types of things, it's something that I would hope the department would say, this is an important priority, that when the public looks at our facilities, they see excellence. And unfortunately, I don't think that that's where we currently are. And so I'd hope to see something as a priority from the department, that excellence is where we need to be.
Okay, Director Gibson.
To the chair, Representative Bynum. Representative Bynum, I don't disagree with you, but we have been focused in the last couple of years of making it a priority to know what we have so that we can appropriately address what we have, which is also why you see Ketchikan Court and Office Building with two separate funded projects, because we went through our condition assessments. We put the focus on understanding what the condition of our buildings were, and a lot of those are remote and difficult, you know. There's a lack of information sometimes, but we then went and prioritized some of those buildings, Ketchikan in this case, as some of our top department needs, as one of our top 10, twice, and well, one of our top 10, to make sure we're addressing some of the past lack of maintenance.
Thank you very much. Appreciate okay. It. Any last comments from the three of you?
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
You bet. I want to thank Director Pannone, Director Gibson, and Chief Hodgson for their presentation today. We're going to take a brief at ease at 2:42 and set up for House Bill, don't tell me, 193. We'll be at ease at 2:43.
Okay, I'll call this meeting of the House Finance Committee back to order at 2:45 p.m. on Wednesday, March 18th. And we have one bill before the committee this afternoon, and that is House Bill 193. It's unemployment benefits and paid parental leave. We heard this bill once last year, so we are going to receive a recap of the bill. And then we'll take public testimony, and then we'll move over to fiscal notes, if time permits. And so with that, if I could have Representative Hall and her staff, Joan Wilkerson, please come up to the table. And if you can put yourself on the record, looks like it's just you today, I think. Mr. Oh, no, we've got staff here. And so if you could go ahead and put yourselves on the record and give us a recap of the bill, and then we'll move over to also I'd like to note that we do have folks available for questions. We've got Paloma Harbor with Division of Employment, Lennon Weller, Research and Analysis, Actuarial, and Kim Kolvig, Legislative Liaison for Department of Labor. And so with that, thanks for being here, and go ahead and get us started.
Thank you very, very much, Mr. Co-Chair. For the record, my name is Carolyn Hall. I represent House District 16, the West Anchorage neighborhoods of Turnigan, Spinard, and Sand Lake. And with me today is my Chief of Staff, who's carrying the bill, Ms. Joan Wilkerson. Thank you very much to the committee for allowing us the opportunity to refresh the memory of House Bill 193, Version H, which does two things. And the two things that HB 193 aims to do is to update the unemployment insurance weekly benefits and create a paid parental leave program. I forgot that I'm driving the bus up here. So unemployment insurance benefits. The state of Alaska requires employers to collect unemployment insurance contributions, or UI contributions, on behalf of employees. And that includes an employer contribution of 1% and an employee contribution of 0.5%. And Alaska's employee contribution is unique because just three states have employee contributions. Already, private and public employers are familiar with UI, the contributions, the benefits, and the payroll process. Currently, the way that unemployment insurance for the state of Alaska works is that there is a current max qualifying, not taxable, as my slide says here. That was a mistake on my part. There is a current max qualifying wage base of $42,000 a year, providing a max benefit of $370 per week. There's also a dependent benefit of $24 a week, and that is up to three dependents. The last time UI benefits were adjusted was in 2009, and meanwhile, employer and employee contribution rates have not meaningfully changed, especially in the last 2 years. Hence, the UI Trust Fund is significantly overcapitalized. In the current version of HB 193, that's version H, the bill aims to increase the max qualifying, again, not taxable, as the slide indicates, that's my mistake, increases the max qualifying wage base to $85,000 a year with a max benefit of $817 per week. It also adjusts the dependent benefit to $72 a week, and again, up to three dependents. Significantly, it also allows the Department of Labor and Workforce Development to adjust the UI wage base and the weekly benefit for inflation. That will help keep us from going so long between updates and finding ourselves in a similar overcapitalization situation with the UI Trust Fund.
Okay, we've got a question. Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair. Thank you, Representative Hall, for being here today and presenting. Can you clarify again, is there was a mistake on slide 4 and 5, and is it the word taxable should be something different?
That is correct. Oh, Representative, excuse me, through the co-chair, Representative Bynum, yes, that is correct. And if it appeases the committee, someone from the Department of Labor, smarter than me and who knows what they're talking about, could better explain it. But yes, the word that should be there instead of taxable is qualifying.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay. All right. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. So the paid parental leave, the second part of the bill. Paid parental leave in general is known to improve health and life outcomes of infants and parents of newborns. It also allows for bonding time with foster and adopted children. Other leave types include the Federal Family Medical Leave Act, or FEMLA, and that provides job-protected unpaid absences up to 12 weeks. Importantly, in 2019, President Trump signed the National Defense Authorization Act, which authorized up to 12 weeks of paid parental leave for federal employees. Alaska has the Alaska Family Leave Act, or AFLA, and that provides up to 18 weeks of unpaid absence for state employees, I believe some public employees, and employers over a certain size. Additional benefits of paid parental leave include providing a well-known and highly valuable benefit at low cost. It allows parents to re-enter the workforce without being penalized. And Alaska is in competition with many states for young, talented workers. And all other states are pursuing these policies. Alaska cannot afford to be left behind. Other states, as I mentioned, are pursuing their own policies. And as an example, in 2020, 5 states had paid family leave. And in 2026, we now have 13 states that have paid leave. A paid parental leave policy will help attract employees in the public and private sectors. And Mr. Co-Chair, importantly, there was recent polling done within the last 1 to 2 years indicating that Gen Z folks are particularly seeking paid parental leave policies when selecting where they choose to live or work. So the bill in its current version, House Bill 193, creates a paid parental leave program. It covers adoption, fostering, childbirth, and placement of a child with a legal guardian in a tribal or state court.
It gives the Department of Labor the ability to set the paid parental leave duration between 8 and 26 weeks. It also creates an optional accelerated benefit to where participants can use 2 times the benefit schedule for half the duration. It runs concurrently with other benefits such as FMLA and AFLA. It also includes a tax cut for employers, and importantly, none of these changes require UGF. And I have an upcoming slide in 2 slides from now that really kind of walks through how the DGF kind of breaks down.
Got a question, Representative Allard.
I didn't want to totally interrupt that. I can hold it to, we're just going to have to flip back though. I just have a.
Sure, go ahead.
Okay. So we're going to go, help me a little bit. I'm sorry, Representative Hall, through the co-chair. Right now, we currently have paid leave for parental paid leave. Do we or do we not? Just for clarification.
Representative Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Through the Co-Chair, Representative Allard, Alaska does not have a paid leave system in place, and that includes all types of leave. May I?
Representative Allard.
When we take leave, we have leave, and then we have for state employees and sick leave, and it's combined with the state. Do you know of any other states that do that? Meaning like when it's together. You don't just like, let me give an example. When I work for the federal government, I was able to take sick leave versus taking leave. There were 2 different entities. And I'm just trying to, as a state, we combine those two. It's not separated. Am I correct on that? Anybody? I think I am. Through the co-chair, Representative Allard, if I'm understanding your question correctly, it depends on your employer. And so, most employees include sick leave mm-hmm. that can be banked, and then you can have paid time off in that way. But when it comes to a paid parental leave or paid family leave, paid family medical leave, Alaska does not have paid leave programs that would cover like maternity leave or medical leave or okay. family leave.
Okay, I apologize. So what we're saying here in this particular bill, it just came in front of me. I'm so sorry that we want to hold private sector accountable to on this bill that they would have to provide 8 to 26 weeks of paid parental leave. Am I correct on that?
Representative Hall.
Through the co-chair, Representative Allard, the bottom line more or less is yes. And in 2 slides from now, we get into the cost breakdown as far as what that means when it comes to impacts to businesses. And the last 2 slides of the presentation also include suggested policy recommendations for the committee to consider based on extensive stakeholder outreach that we have done over the past several months. So the current version that's in front of you is as I've been walking through, but we do have policy recommendations and suggestions for the committee to consider at a future date.
Okay. And then I'm just going to hold off to listen to the slides. I was just trying to figure out how a business is going to be able to hold a spot for someone for 6 months. That's a lot for a small business. They're struggling right now. Okay, I'll just wait till she's done with the slides.
Okay. Also, I'd like to note that we do have in the audience with us Representative Eichheit. Thanks for joining us here. And so, Representative Hall, please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. And if I could just make a very brief comment to Representative Allard, your concerns are certainly well-founded, and we have recommendations based on business feedback to address your comment.
So, okay.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Other changes in 193. So you have those 2 main components, which is updating the unemployment insurance benefits and then creating the paid parental leave program. Additionally, what the bill does is it directs the Department of Labor and Workforce Development to conduct actuarial studies on the paid parental leave fund to ensure its solvency. And that is to happen every 2 years. It also allows the Department of Labor to adjust the UI wage base and benefit for inflation. And it allows mechanisms for the department to protect the UI fund solvency. Additionally, it calls for an increase in funding for the STEP program, and that comes at the request of the department.
So this is one of those aforementioned slides that as unemployment insurance stands now, this is what the contributions do. So there's an overall UI tax rate of 1.5%. Half a percent of that comes from employee contributions. And currently, 0.35% of that half percent go to the STEP and TVET programs. And the remaining 0.15% goes into the UI trust fund. And as it stands now, the employer contribution rate is 1%, and that fully, wholly goes to the UI trust fund. What HB 193 proposes to do in its current form is to take the employee tax rate of 0.5% and continue having 0.35% going into the STEP program, with the remaining 0.15%, instead of going into the UI trust fund, going to create a paid parental leave fund. What the bill aims to do with the current, with the employer contribution rate of 1% is have 0.1% go to the STEP program. And again, that comes at the request of the Department of Labor. 0.2% goes to the paid parental leave program and trust fund. 0.5% would go to the UI trust fund, and there's enough wiggle room there to where employers can see a 0.2% tax cut. This bill in its current form has been stress test by the Department of Labor under catastrophic economic conditions. And through all of that modeling that the department has done, the UI trust fund does remain solvent in those catastrophic circumstances to where we can still contribute to STEP, we can still contribute to the paid parental leave program, and still contribute to the UI trust fund while maintaining UI trust fund solvency. I will certainly defer to the experts, the Department of Labor, to walk through the modeling if you so choose, Mr. Co-Chair, but there has been extensive modeling done to ensure that no matter what, the UI trust fund is the priority and that it remains solvent. And there's even snapback language in the bill in its current form that says if there's concern about the solvency of the UI trust fund, then the contributions that are going into STEP and paid parental leave can be sent instead to the UI trust fund to ensure its long-term health.
Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Through the chair, Representative Hall, on this particular slide here, we show that there's this 1.5% rate, 0.5 to the employee, 1% to the employer, but then at the very end we say tax cut. So is that tax cut actually going to the employer so that their rate's going to be 0.8? Or is that tax cut go back to the beginning and then it's going to be distributed? Or does it go to the employee? Has it been defined?
Representative Hall?
Mr. Co-Chair, through the Co-Chair, Representative Bynum, it would be a 0.20% tax cut for employers.
Thank you.
Okay, please proceed. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. So as previously mentioned, we have done extensive stakeholder outreach and engagement over the past handful of months. And based on that feedback, these two slides contain policy considerations for the committee. And that includes reducing the paid parental leave benefit from a range of 8 to 26 weeks to a range of 8 to 12 weeks. And that comes based on an organization we were in touch with that specifically helps businesses administer paid leave programs. And they said that the national average is 12 weeks. So that is why I include that here on the slide. Also, based on business feedback, the committee could consider setting a threshold for the number of employees as far as whether a business is required to provide this paid parental leave. So basically saying it should the cap maybe be 10 employees, 25 employees, 50 employees, like to basically help small businesses.
Question, Representative Allard.
Thank you. And through the co-chair, Representative Hall, this is back where we were kind of going and you said there were slides. I'm super concerned. You're asking perhaps others as a body to come up with that solution of what makes it workable, whether it's 10 employees, which there's no way. Any business that has 10 employees and they're missing one for 6 months or 4 months would be probably catastrophic for that business. We saw that during COVID. So do you, as the sponsor of the bill, have a recommendation and any math to show it?
Representative Hall?
Through the co-chair, Representative Allard, my personal opinion is that I would like to see a threshold of 25 employees. However, I did have a conversation with a small business owner this morning, and she was walking through how, from her perspective and other small businesses' perspectives, their preference would be the threshold being 50.
May I just do one follow-up?
Representative Hall, Allard.
Thank you. It's through the co-chair. So I'm just, how many businesses, because this is clearly a lot of work, how many businesses have you spoken to? Right now we're having small businesses throwing up their arms over ballot measure one, where they can't even pay for people who want to take sick leave and bank it and then leave because they can't hire somebody in the place because then they're paying two for the price of zero. How many businesses have you actually spoken to across the state, how they feel about doing this, small businesses? And I'm just curious.
Representative Please. Hall.
Through the co-chair, Representative Allard, the groups we have been in touch with is the Anchorage Chamber of Commerce. I've spoken with them about the bill two or three times now. I also spoke with the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation, the Juneau Chamber of Commerce, or might have been the Juneau Economic Development Corporation. We've also been in touch with the Fairbanks Economic Development Corporation and the Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce. And then one-off businesses here and there, I instituted a habit with, based on the people who were visiting me in my office this session, if they had a business or I thought that they might have some feedback that they might want to provide to this bill, I would mention the bill to them and they would offer their thoughts.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
Representative Hall.
Let's see, I think we're only down to one more slide. I do have a lineup of Representative Bynum, Galvin, and more, but we also have public testimony, and I want to make sure that folks in the public have an opportunity to provide that testimony. So I'm going to maybe ask Representative Hall if you could finish up the presentation, then we'll go to public testimony, then we'll circle back to questions. So Representative Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Third bullet on this slide, a recommendation is to exempt businesses that already have a leave program that is as good as HB 193 or more generous. The bill, I think that it would also be wise for the committee to consider exempting seasonal employers. Additionally, that fourth bullet there were two competing understandings of the qualifying purpose for that bullet number four. And I conferred with the Department of Labor just before this meeting that bullet point actually is incorrect. There were two competing understandings of what that bullet point says. And so the correct what it should say is clarify the qualifying purpose is $2,500 in wages earned for two quarters total. So not the $5,000 that is listed there. And I appreciate the Department of Labor confirming that that is their interpretation of that, of what that bullet should say. The last slide has to do with potentially reducing the UI max qualifying wage base from $85,000 a year to $54,500 a year, and having the weekly benefit go from $817 a week down to $525 a week. And the reason for that, Mr. Co-Chair, is because upon further reflection, and myself being really inclined towards fiscal conservativeness, it may be wise to reduce that max qualifying wage base and the weekly benefit to further protect the UI fund solvency for the long run. Second bullet here, I think it would behoove the bill, and if I had to guess, probably the Department of Labor as well, just trying to improve the alignment between the language that is in the paid parental leave section of the bill and aligning it with the UI statutes regarding contributions to ensure that there's more similarities there than differences. Additionally, there's language in the bill that if we were to update, it would be really helpful when it comes to federal compliance. And I think that's really, really important. The third bullet there has to do with polishing the snapback language that I mentioned previously to ensure the UI fund solvency. I think it makes sense to have the snapback language to be have funds or those contributions that are going into the paid parental leave program for those funds to go to the UI fund first before any funds are essentially redirected from the STEP program to the UI fund. I think it would be really important to exempt the paid parental leave fund from the sweep to ensure that it is a lasting benefit for those who qualify. And lastly, I strongly advocate for the effective date to be January 1st, 2029 for two reasons. One is to allow the Department of Labor enough time to implement, administer, do what they need to do to get this program off the ground. Additionally, it allows for over the course of time for funds to accumulate in the paid parental leave program so the benefit can be distributed. With that, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Great. Thank you very much. I'm going to jump right into public testimony, and then we'll come back to committee questions. So with that, officially opening public testimony on House Bill 193. And if folks would like to submit written testimony, they can do so by emailing us at house.finance@akleg.gov. I wonder if maybe a couple of windows can be cracked just a little bit. I think it's a little warm in here. And so first up in the room here, it looks like we have maybe three or four people in the room. I believe Maureen Hall, if you'd like to put yourself on the record, just state your name and your affiliation. And proceed with your testimony, and thanks so very much for joining us here today.
Yeah, Chair and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. For the record, my name is Maureen Hall, and I live here in Juneau. I'm a registered nurse with over 30 years' experience primarily serving children and families. I'm retired from school nursing and now serving on the City and Borough Assembly. However, I'm not speaking as an assembly member. I am also the mother of four and grandmother of eight. I speak in strong support of House Bill 193, an act establishing a paid parental leave program, because this bill helps solve several interconnected problems facing Alaskan families. First, families are struggling with the lack of affordable child care, especially infant care, which is consistently the most expensive and hardest to find. For many households, the math simply does not work without two incomes, yet returning to work immediately after the birth of a child is detrimental to the well-being of both the parent and the baby. Second, paid parental leave supports family stability and economic security. When parents are forced back to work too early, families face impossible choices between income, bonding, and care. This program gives families breathing room at one of the most critical moments of their lives. Third, Alaska, like much of the country, is experiencing declining birth rates. Paid parental leave is not a silver bullet, but it's an important tool in a broader toolkit to make Alaska a place where young families feel supported and confident about starting and growing their families. Finally, and most importantly, the early weeks of infancy really matter. This is a period that is critical for brain development and bonding. Paid leave allows parents to provide the responsive, nurturing care that builds a strong foundation for lifelong health and learning. Babies with stable, consistent caregivers have better developmental outcomes. That time is critical for bonding with the primary caregiver and for healthy development. HB 193 sends a clear message. Alaska values families and children and the workforce that sustains our state. This bill will make Alaska a more attractive place to live, work, and raise a family. I respectfully urge your support of House Bill 193, and thank you.
Great. Thank you so very much. Do we have any questions from the committee? Seeing none, thank you very much for being here. Before we go online to the phones, is there anyone else in the room who would like to testify? I don't see anybody, so we're going to go. It looks like we have five people online, for just so folks know online how long the wait might be. And the first person I have here is Dennis Young, calling in from Juneau. If you can state your name and your affiliation. Dennis Young, are you there? We'll come back to Mr. Young, not there now. Okay. So next up, we'll come back to Mr. Young here. Let's try, Dina Klimkina calling in from, looks like, Versailles, Kentucky. If you're there, if you can state your name and your affiliation.
Hello. Thank you so much to the chair and members of the committee for having us here today. My name is Dina Klimkina, and I'm here on behalf of the Disability Management Employer Coalition to provide testimony regarding HB 193. We are the only association dedicated to providing education, knowledge, and networking for 20,000 absence management professionals from over 2,000 employers. And we really appreciate Alaska's efforts to establish a paid parental leave program. We are here to provide several technical recommendations for the committee's consideration based on our knowledge and experience of administering leave policies throughout the country. Our first area of feedback is in regards to benefits duration. The proposed bill proposes up to 26 of paid leave, whereas most state paid leave programs provide a maximum of 12 weeks and a benefit duration of 12 to 16 weeks would better align with national standards and reduce risk of fund insolvency, which could trigger future tax increases for employees and employers. The bill also allows benefit duration to shift between 18 and 26 weeks annually based on the solvency of the fund. And this variability might create planning challenges for employers and insurance carriers to administer supplemental benefits. So we believe a fixed benefit duration would provide more predictability and administrative consistency. Next, Connecticut, Massachusetts, and Washington all allow employers to satisfy their obligations through an approved private insurance plan that meets or exceeds state program requirements. The committee may want to consider whether adding a private plan exemption would align Alaska's program with the approach taken by other states. Further, several provisions would benefit from clarification before implementation, including wage eligibility calculations, whether leave can be taken intermittently, and how benefits are coordinated. And finally, we recommend a minimum of 18 to 24 months between enactment and start of benefits to allow for claims processing infrastructure to be set up, employers to update payroll systems, and insurance carriers to develop compliant products. We do have other feedback, and I wanted to answer a question that was asked earlier about the difference between leave and sick time. Whereas leave is an approved period of extended absence for particular reasons, time off refers to planned or unplanned time away from work. And paid leave ensures employees receive all or at least part of their wages during absence, while unpaid leave provides job protection without wages. The time off does not provide that job protection. So that was in reference to earlier. But we are more than welcome to provide any clarity or any other research or details. We really commend you on doing this work. And the NEC is more than happy to provide you any support in your efforts. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Klimkina. In terms of some of the recommendations that you have, I don't see an email or anything in my packet. Just wanted to make sure if you would like, if you could maybe forward those recommendations to us in writing, and then we can make sure the committee has those.
This call is no longer being recorded.
Oh.
Thank you.
Are you there?
We are more than happy to provide you the email, and we will coordinate internally as well.
Great. Thank you very much. Do we have any questions from the committee? Okay, seeing none, thank you for calling in. Next up, I have Ms. Laura Steele calling in from Juneau. If you can state your name and your affiliation.
Hi, thank you for having me today. My name is Laura Steele calling from Juneau on behalf of myself. Yes, I'm calling on behalf of myself, but I'm also calling to speak for my two daughters. Lucy is 5 and June is 10 months old. Neither myself nor my husband had paid parental leave for the birth of either of our children, so Lucy in 2020 or June in spring of last year. This required us to both max out our personal leave as well as take unpaid leave in order to both bond and care for them as newborns and allowing myself time to heal. So this put an undue financial hardship on our family during an already vulnerable time, a time that should be special and magical and treasured, not when you should be stressing about finances. So when my daughter was born last spring, all I had to use was 2 weeks of paid time off. Our family is incredibly fortunate to have made it possible for me to take 10 additional weeks unpaid. But if our circumstances had been different, I would have been back to week at 2 weeks postpartum. For me personally, and I know many women who have been in similar circumstances, that would have meant working with 2 fourth-degree cares, for the uninitiated, that's the care all the way through, recovering with over 50 stitches still in place, leaking milk, and getting between 3 and 5 hours of broken sleep every night. So at that time, I would say I was fueled by love for the tiny person in my arms and not much else, and in no place to be working or doing much else but caring for her and recovering myself. So with respect to the committee, your constituents, Alaskan families, we hear all the time from yourselves and your colleagues that you care so much about families, you care about children, you care about the future of Alaska. So use this time to show us that you care. Paid parental leave provides significant health benefits and increased economic outcomes. I heard the statistic earlier. There are many more that weren't even touched on. A decrease in infant and maternal mortality, a decrease in maternal stress and anxiety, higher rates of breastfeeding, lower rates of intimate partner violence. The list goes on, and you don't need me to read it off to you. But I would love for your body to stand on business and show Alaskans how much you do support them. So for my family and many others, this initiative would be life-changing. Also, little to no direct cost to the state. So I'd like to urge you in joining me in support for HB 193. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Steele. Do we have any questions from the committee? I don't see any. So with that, thank you for your testimony. We're next going to go to, looks like we have 3 more people. Heidi Dragas calling in from Anchorage. If you can state your name and your affiliation.
Thank you to the members of the committee for hearing this important bill. My name is Heidi Dragas, and I serve as executive director for the Alaska State Employees Association. We represent nearly 9,000 state and municipal workers across Alaska. I also speak as a former commissioner of labor and workforce development who pursued a long overdue increase to Alaska's out-of-date maximum weekly UI benefit. HB 193 will strengthen Alaska's workforce, support working families, and provide long-term economic stability for our state. Unemployment benefits in Alaska have not been increased in 17 years. A lot has happened in those intervening years to costs facing Alaska's families, leaving many extremely vulnerable during periods of transition or job loss. Costs are soaring in Alaska and across the state. By updating unemployment benefits, we are taking a long overdue step to modernize the system and align it with the current cost increases facing workers today. What's more, our UI Trust Fund can more than adequately absorb these increases. As many of the committee are aware, Alaska has faced a long-term out-migration crisis. We are not just losing state workers, we are losing working-age Alaskans and their families across all fields and sectors. HB 193 is truly a workforce stability measure important to numerous industries in Alaska. Paid parental leave is a popular and worthy investment. It increases employee retention, it leads to healthier child development and stronger economic participation. Studies even show that it can increase revenue and profits for private sector organizations. This policy is good for both the employee and employer, regardless of the sector. As public employees and union members, we see firsthand how economic insecurity affects morale, productivity, and long-term stability. HB 193 is a commitment to the dignity of work, the value of families, and the belief that Alaskans should not have to choose between caring for a newborn or paying the bills after a layoff. Finally, as a lifelong Alaskan and someone who is deeply invested in the state, and from my perspective as a mother of a young child, Alaska is facing some big problems as a state. In my opinion, it's time for the legislature to take bold action to address some of the biggest challenges for our workers. This is one of those challenges. This is a bold solution, but it is also a smart one. This bill is an innovative solution to a problem that's plaguing our workforce. I want to thank Representative Hall for sponsoring this bill, and I urge your support. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much, Ms. Dragas. I don't see any questions from the committee. I'm going to just round back really quick. It looks like Dennis Young is not online, but I just want to double check. Mr. Young, are you there? And it appears that is not the case. So we will come back to our last two testifiers. Ms. Julie Fix calling in from Juneau, if you can state your name and your affiliation.
Hi, everyone. My name is Julie Fix, and I'm just your average working mom living here in Juneau. Thank you so much for the opportunity to share a little bit of my story and voice my support for HB 193. My maternity leave was partially funded by the generosity of my coworkers. I received 2 weeks of donated vacation leave from them. Saying this out loud makes me feel incredibly emotional and moved by how impactful it was and how supported I felt by my coworkers. But at the same time, it's incredibly frustrating that it has come to this. By the time I had my daughter, I exhausted all of my accrued leave to experiencing significant nausea and vomiting for most of my pregnancy and to attend countless doctor's appointments. This meant that most of my maternity leave was without pay, which was incredibly financially stressful. Even if I wanted to return to work at 3 months postpartum or earlier, it simply was not an option due to a child care shortage, specifically impacting infant care, despite having been on all of the wait lists since I was 12 weeks pregnant. This put my new little family of three in a really tough position. I needed to go back to work for the income, but I couldn't because there was no infant child care available. It was not until my daughter was 5 months that we found some sort of child care solution, and then 9 months, something more reliable and consistent. Somehow here we are 2.5 years later, and we are considering doing this all over again. If I look at the numbers, it really does not make sense for us to have another child. We really can't afford to take 3 to 6 months of leave without pay for even one parent, not let alone both. And we really can't afford to have two children in daycare. For context, we are two college-educated millennials with quote-unquote good jobs, and at the end of the month, it feels like we live paycheck to paycheck and are barely able to save anything. It's no wonder that I have friends choosing to move down south to start their families in states that have stronger support systems for new families. We are even considering it. As many of you know, the first year of parenthood is a roller coaster with so much uncertainty and so much unknown. By creating this new paid parental leave program, families would have more stability and reduced stress so that they can focus on and begin to learn the most important job of their life and heal from pregnancy and childbirth and bond with their new child. 3 to 6 months is such a blip in time in the grand scheme of life, but it is so impactful and can really change the trajectory for a family to be successful. Speaking of bonding, when we talk about family leave, we often cite bonding as the main reasons for taking time off work. I think we need to deconstruct this term and be a little bit more honest about what bonding in the first year of life with an infant really means. I've been listening out on committee hearings for the past year and hear this term being thrown around, and I just don't get the sense that the gravity of early postpartum is really being captured, and in some instances is equated to a paid vacation to snuggle and stare at your newborn. So here's a very brief, slightly censored description of what bonding looked like for me in the context of a challenging but normal pregnancy and a very challenging and long but uncomplicated birth. Bonding is physically and emotionally healing from childbirth and the body adjusting to the empty space left behind by your baby and placenta. Bonding is anemia from blood loss in childbirth. Bonding is countless appointments with lactation consultants to figure out how to feed your baby. Who knew something so essential to human survival could be so devastatingly complicated and hard? Bonding is physical therapy to address pelvic organ prolapse. Bonding is breast milk management and dealing with clogged ducts, nipple trauma, engorgement, and mastitis. Bonding is caring for a sick baby that is too young for certain vaccines and medicines while being sick yourself. Bonding is attending a Microsoft Teams meeting with your camera off and your infant in your lap because there's no available infant care in Juno. Bonding is going a whole day without eating because you've been taking care of everyone but yourself. Bonding is only getting 2 to 3 hour chunks of sleep at a time for months on end. And as an aside on chronic sleep deprivation, trust me, you do not want me back at work before 3 to 6 months and actually may save money by paying me to stay away. Amongst the painful, desperate, exhausting moments, there are so many beautiful and blissful and magical moments interwoven. It's well past time to start supporting policies that give young families and children a better start. I fully support HB 193 for both parents and for new parents of foster or adopted children. I also support paid leave for other qualifying FMLA, AFLA conditions. I know that if I was to have another child, being able to access a paid parental leave program would be life-changing. I believe it will also be an asset to employers in keeping talented workers in Alaska and attracting workforce talent from the lower 48. Thank you so much for your time and consideration.
Great. Thank you, Ms. Fix. We do have a question, but before we go to that question, we might be losing some folks here at the end of our time. My intent is to take up, looks like we have Mr. Young back on, and then we have picked up two more people. So we've got a total of four testifiers. We'll take those. My plan is to go ahead and adjourn out once we're done with that. We will take up the questions in order in which I receive those. So we've got Bynum, Galvin, Moore, and Josephson when we come back to this. At our next meeting, we'll take up the fiscal notes. We'll take up let's see here. We may also have a CS because I think Representative Hall had some recommendations and would like to incorporate that to a new CS. And then we'll come back to questions at the next meeting. So with that, I'm going to jump right back into finishing up with public testimony, and then we'll call it a day. Representative Galvin, you had a question for Ms. Fix.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Really, I just have a quick comment. You introduced yourself, Ms. Fix, as an average working mom. And I just want to let you know that from my perspective, you're clearly an extraordinary mom and person. And to be here testifying and thinking of not just yourself, but others, and giving such a very clear picture of how this could impact you and others is remarkable. Thank you.
Okay. Do we have any further questions from the committee? Representative Jimmy?
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. It's more just of a comment to Mrs. Fix. I just empathize with you, and I could cry just hearing your testimony and understand what you're talking about. I just want to thank you for giving us a really good insight, Guyana.
Okay, I don't see any further comments. Thank you very much, Ms. Fix, for being here, testifying. I'm going to go back up to Dennis Young. If you could state your name and your affiliation. Looks like you're calling in from Juneau.
Good afternoon, House Finance Committee. My name is Dennis Young. I'm with the ILWU Alaska Longshore Division, representing longshoremen all across Alaska. Calling in to support HB 193. We encourage the modernization of Alaska's unemployment benefits. Alaska unemployment benefits have not been updated since 2009, and Alaska currently ranks near the bottom nationally in wage replacement. It's time to change that, and HB 193 is a great start. HB 193 supports working families and ensures they can save time to welcome a new child without losing all income. The bill keeps skilled workers connected to the communities and the workforce and allows workers to take parental leave without fully without fully separating from employment, helping retain experienced workers. Access to UI benefits during parental leave provides predictable temporary wage support. Alaska UI Trust Fund is currently at $700 million and growing, is very healthy and capable of supporting benefit adjustments. In fiscal year 2024, the Department of Revenue was, or excuse me, revenue to the UI fund was $165.9 million, while only $45.3 million was paid in benefits, which is a net of approximately $120 million and growing each year. The fund can and should increase benefits, which is why we support HB 193, and we would welcome additional improvements to unemployment benefits to help Alaska's workforce into the future. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Young. I don't see any questions, so I appreciate your testifying. The last three testifiers we have, next is Ms. Julie Cleeton calling in from Anchorage. If you can state your name and your affiliation.
Hello, my name is Julie Cleeton, and I serve as president of the Alaska Public Health Association. We support paid parental leave. Since 2013, the American Public Health Association has advocated for paid sick leave and family leave policies. They cite several well-studied benefits of parental leave, including fewer preterm births, reductions in C-section deliveries, more well-baby visits, decreased infant mortality, longer periods of breastfeeding, and improved mental health of new mothers. In some studies, these positive effects are identified only when the parental leave is paid. Parental leave can be life-saving, and investments in early childhood pay huge dividends for society later in life. On behalf of the Alaska Public Health Association, I urge you to pass this paid parental leave bill out of committee without excluding small business employees. We would also support future expansions to family and medical leave. Speaking only for myself now, I would love to see this bill pass quickly. I'm 32, I don't have children yet, and part of the reason why is that I've been saving up vacation days for years so I can afford to have what my coworkers jokingly call maternity vacation. Many workers can't even do that and instead lose their jobs or give up their careers, which is tough for new parents and for Alaska when we're short on labor. Thank you, representatives, for your time and consideration.
Great. Thank you very much, Ms. Cleeton, for your testimony. Next, we're going to go to Scott Hummel calling in from Fairbanks. If you can state your name and your affiliation.
Hi, representatives and committee members. My name is Scott Hummel calling from Fairbanks, Alaska. It's my first time calling in to anything with you guys, but I was emboldened by Rep. Paul today to make this phone call. As a new father to a 20-month-old baby and a working mom, a husband to a working mom with school district, I wanted to call in and offer support for paid furlough and updating the UI schedule for payment benefits. However, I would like to run more numbers past this committee as back of the napkin math indicates that the $817 maximum benefit for an individual making $85,000 a year would only account for 35% of their take-home salary. As we have no doubt heard in this committee, the hardships of not having 100% of your income on meeting your bills and obligations are distressing, to say the least, and a challenge which takes up an immense amount of time and energy, especially during the early months of adjusting and healing after giving birth to a baby. In addition, FINWA is not just for infant development and childhood, welcoming a cute child into your life, but it's also for those really difficult points in which you have experienced the loss of a family member or some extreme hardship, which have impacted your ability to perform at work and need time off for work. Without 100% paid compensation for those intervals, whether they're 6 weeks, 2 weeks, 12 weeks, or 25 weeks, it can be very, very difficult to properly and completely heal and recover because you're continually worried about meeting your bills and your obligations. So I applaud the committee and, of course, Rep. Hall for bringing this to you guys. And I would also strongly encourage you to do what you can within the solvency and the pay structure of the new system that would be augmented to focus on 100% or even 70% income replacement, because 35.7% with the max benefit of $817 would continue to press strain on those individuals we're trying to help And I would encourage you not to do something just for the sake of doing something, but do something that actually completely makes this intimate period of time in people's lives, whether it's the loss of a loved one or welcoming a brand new baby, not as much of a financial burden by seeking to do the 100% income replacement. My recent tax learning just identified that you only get $600 tax credit on your taxes when you're paying up to $18,000 or $24,000 a year for childhood care. And the Alaska State Child Care Assistance Program, you're ineligible if you make more than $62,000 a year. So families that make between $62,000 a year and, say, $200,000 a year are pinched in between all of these new expenses that will go with the joy of parenthood. And that's crux of my imploring of you guys is, yes, the UI benefits need to be updated. $370 a week is not going to cut it anymore. And I would also encourage you to focus on what we can for solvency to make 100% income replacement, whether it's 6 weeks or it's 50% for 12 weeks, whatever it might be. But continue to work on this issue because paid leave for these moments of whether they're hardship or joy is truly an important component to working life in families with two working parents these days. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Helmholtz. You had some specific recommendations, and we would certainly welcome an email if you're interested to see that in writing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, great.
Yeah, I'll be happy to follow up with an email, but I was encouraged by that call, and so here I am being bold and courageous, calling into you guys to offer a perspective of this and how much it means not only to women and wives and mothers, but also to husbands and fathers, to be there to support our women and our babies in these moments. And so this isn't truly just a unisex type subject or discussion matter. This is a family focused issue. So, thank you very much for your time.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Helmholtz. And for anybody else who would like to submit written testimony, they can do so by emailing us at house.finance@akleg.gov. And we're going to go to our last test fire here, and that's Jordan Hollersmith calling in from, looks like Ms. or Mr. Hollersmith is no longer available, I believe. Jordan Hollersmith, if you're there. Okay, so is there anybody else in the room or online who would like to testify that I may have missed? Seeing none, I'm going to go ahead and close public testimony on House Bill 193. And so with that, as I mentioned a while ago, we're going to go ahead and adjourn out, and the plan will be to bring the bill back before us and address the fiscal notes. We will roll out a committee substitute, and we'll come back to questions. And in the queue, I had Representative Bynum, Galvin, Moore, and Josephson. And so with that, if there is nothing else to come for the committee, our next meeting is scheduled for tomorrow morning, March 19 at 9 a.m. And at that meeting, we'll be rolling out a committee substitute for House Bill 280. That is the highly digitized tax bill. And if there's nothing else to come for the committee, we will be adjourned at 3:41 p.m. Thank you.